I'm Leonida Inge. This is Test It from WUNC, a look at what the day's challenges tell us about where we are, what we believe, and who we want to be in North Carolina and the South. Today, clinical trials for all. When my youngest son, Teemer, was little, we'd keep a bittersweet summer tradition. We'd hop in the car and head to Stokesdale, North Carolina, where I'd drop him off at a camp designed for children living with chronic diseases. Teemer has sickle cell disease. The camp was called Camp Carefree. I always loved that name. For a few weeks, kids like mine, ages 6 to 16, could connect with each other under the Carolina sun, and enough supervision to make us doting parents feel safe. The summer of 2017 was especially memorable because that's when word began circulating that the FDA had approved a new drug for those living with sickle cell disease, called Endari. Sickle cell is an inherited disorder that makes it mighty damn hard for red blood cells to carry oxygen throughout the body. You see, the cells are not round. They are crescent-shaped, like a sickle, and can get all jumbled up. The result? Major pain, organ damage, and worse. Endari was the first drug approved for sickle cell patients in 20 years. Along with the excitement and relief came questions. Why? What took so long? Some say it had to do with the fact that sickle cell affects mostly Black people, which left it low on the priority list for Big Pharma. But it's also extremely hard to find enough African Americans to participate in a necessary step for drug testing and approval, clinical trials. Now that COVID-19 is another health issue disproportionately pressing on minority communities, will Black and brown people step forward to take part? At Camp Carefree in 2017, I got a chance to talk to other parents of kids with sickle cell disease, some who hadn't even learned a new drug had hit the market.
So what do you think even about this new drug, you know, because, I mean, would you have even let your child be a part of a trial for a drug?
No.
No.
Because
that was our whole point at the beginning, to help her immune system develop on its own.
That's James and Sheila Martin from High Point. Their daughter has sickle cell.
They say if we don't take part in these trials, I don't know, it can't help other people. Even if it doesn't help you, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, it could help
you don't like
else.
Trials. You don't like tests. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't like being a guinea pig. But now you got to have those tests out there. But I think.
There it is. Nobody wants to be the guinea pig. And many African Americans have stories to share of experiences with doctors displaying their biases on our treatment. Or rattle off the many times in history our bodies have been used or misused for the sake of science. Does the name Henrietta Lacks ring a bell? The most famous of these mass medical abuses is, of course, the Tuskegee syphilis experiments, going back to the 1930s, when the Public Health Service withheld treatment from hundreds of Black men in Alabama who had the disease. Feelings of deep doubt about our medical system are deserved and haven't gone away. A recent survey by the Pew Research Center reports Black Americans are more hesitant to trust medical scientists and experimental medicine than white and Hispanic folks. But there are those among us who counter the common narrative. Monica Summers is the program director at Piedmont Health Services and Sickle Cell Agency in Greensboro. Her teenage son has sickle cell and first participated in a clinical trial for the drug hydroxyurea. He was only 1 year old.
Even now when we talk to people about clinical trials, you know, the first thing they say is, well, I don't want to be a guinea pig and they're just trying things on me. But if we don't have the people to test the medication on, we won't know that it will ever work. You know, we have to have clinical trials in order for the medications to get to the next phase and to help the people that it can help.
Clinical trials are a crucial step for ending the pandemic as soon as possible, and there are many organizations joining the fight. The World Health Organization reports there are more than 150 vaccines in varying stages of development. But how do you make sure everybody is fairly represented in trials for a COVID vaccine, especially when Black and Brown folks have historically been underrepresented in tests, but are dying from the virus at a higher rate?
It is a moral imperative to me to fix this problem. This is not just a theoretical or academic question, like, yeah, it would be great to get more patients in trials, or it would be great to have a greater diversity in trials. The reality is, by not doing it, it is costing us millions of patient lives.
Kent Tolkey is the Chief Scientific Officer and Executive Vice President of PRA Health Sciences. It's a clinical research organization based in Raleigh. The organization is busy running trials for COVID treatments and potential vaccines and is using virtual tools to reach as many participants as possible.
And when you look at clinical trials in general outside of COVID, if you take African Americans as an example, they account for roughly 13 or 14% of the U.S. population. They account for somewhere around 2 to 3% of the clinical trial population. As an industry, both healthcare and drug development, we do a really, really bad job at making sure everybody's included. And where that becomes challenging, it's not just about an access or a care issue. There are biological differences in minority populations that can affect how drugs actually work. And so, I mean, we have drugs certainly that work differently between Black Americans and African Americans than they do in Caucasians. And so if we get a drug approved, where only 2 or 3% of the people we tested it on were Black, we don't have enough data to understand if that product actually works in that population. And yet we get that drug approved and then we market it and your doctor gives it to Black Americans, assuming it will work the same way. That doesn't make any sense on a scientific basis, right?
No.
So there are so many reasons that as an industry, we should be focused on diversity and minority inclusion. What we should see is at least 25% inclusion rates, but it doesn't happen today.
Well, actually, that makes me think about, you know, all the people who have the disease and who have died and the disproportionately high numbers of people of color. When I think of just this country, African Americans and Hispanics. And I'm hoping these people are involved in these clinical trials at a high enough rate that it can actually help this population in the long run.
So one of the things that we are focused on is changing the paradigm for how we access patients. So traditionally, clinical trials require that patients go to a clinical trial site or a hospital to get access to a medication. And then, you know, it's a scientific experiment. So we have the patients come back multiple times. We assess how the drug is working. We look at their blood levels. We look at the impact on whatever symptoms they have. But the reality is for most patients that even that is unattainable. The barrier is too high to be able to leave your job, to go to a clinic, to do all of those things. And much of that is geographic barrier. Some of it is socioeconomic. Some is access to healthcare. We have a mobile platform. We believe that the ability to integrate and access patients and trials through their mobile phones, their smartphones, and kind of virtualize access to care is a critical component to increasing diversity. And so if a minority patient, a Hispanic patient, a Black patient can access a clinical trial and maybe only has to go to the clinic one time, but all the other visits can be done virtually through their phone or through connected healthcare devices, suddenly we can access far more patients because geography becomes less of a barrier, cost of travel, time off, those things that are traditional barriers to participation go away if we can deliver that same care or intervention in a patient's home. And so whether that is a vaccine trial or a trial for a mild to moderately ill COVID patient, we can do much of that at home in a way that expands access to healthcare and to trials via mobile health platforms.
Wow, that's very interesting. I know you've worked a long time with virtual clinical trials. It sounds like a good possibility that it could help a large population of people who may not have, you know, otherwise been involved in clinical trials.
Well, I believe so. I think that, you know, when you think about the COVID vaccine trials, these trials will take hundreds of thousands of patients, right? This is not a trial that only has a couple of hundred patients like we see in sick people. For vaccine trials, the number of vaccines that are in development, which is almost 200, to fulfill all of those trials will take millions of patients. And that is a global issue for us. The only way to do that at scale is to make sure that we make it as easy as possible for all patients to have access. So that means that patients have to have access to testing centers on a broad scale across all communities. And that once patients are tested, if they're negative, that we give them the broadest access point possible to participate in those trials. And we believe when you look at the penetration rates of how many Americans, as an example, have smartphones, the ability for us to engage with those patients in their own home to make sure they get access and that we're monitoring the health of that patient from their own home. We have connected devices. We can manage a patient and monitor their oxygenation of their blood with a pulse oximeter. We can manage their temperature with a digital thermometer. We can manage their blood pressure with a home blood pressure cuff. So there's many things that we can do from a patient's home and monitor them remotely from physicians in virtual or telemedicine or televisits and allow those patients access to participate in trials that really up until the last couple of years, we didn't have access to even do any of that because of technology. But today we can.
Well, it's good to hear that. But what about the trust factor? You know, I've spoken with several people when it comes to clinical trials, say for patients suffering from sickle cell disease. And sometimes they still bring up clinical trials of decades past, going back to this syphilis, you know, experiments and Tuskegee. I mean, so even if you have the technology, even if you had the money to even get to the testing facility, even if you had health insurance, say all that's fine, you know, definitely. How do you make Black people say, you know, I want to be a part of that trial and I trust that those health professionals will use my blood appropriately and that'll actually help me and my people?
So we spend a lot of time listening to patients. So in the social communities, we listen to patients, we understand their concerns. For the African-American population, for Black Americans, we work with community groups to help educate patients. You know, Tuskegee incident, although many, many decades ago now, still lives on strong as a fear. And so we work with the AME Zion Church, as an example, for the Black community to really help educate people on what a clinical trial is, where the value proposition is, where the trust factors are. I think it's very important to be transparent. And so if you're participating in a clinical trial, that we provide you as much information. And this is where the mobile platforms become valuable because we can push content and information to patients directly into a safe environment, which is in their own home, so that they become an active participant in the research and not just having something done to them. So there has to be value on both sides. Patients have got to feel like they're not being treated as a guinea pig, but that it is a collaborative effort for research and that they're getting something from it as well.
What would you say to others in the industry to help achieve this a much higher rate when it comes to participation in clinical trials across the board, you know, with it, more women, more people of certain ages, more people of color? What would you ask them to do?
I think that the pharmaceutical companies and the CROs need to make diversity and inclusion as an equal pillar to every other priority in the trial development paradigm. So we already know how to open clinical trial sites and enroll the standard populations. Equal to that, though, and from a priority perspective should be, do you have an active diversity, minority recruitment plan for your trial? And that means going to regions or cities or areas or hospitals with a high diversity component. It means that you are putting together specific culturally relevant, ethnic relevant outreach and recruitment plans and education materials to those populations. But it has to be a core development of your program. It cannot be a byproduct. So you can't say, well, we had minority participants in our trial, and it was at 4% because we opened a bunch of sites in areas where there was a high African-American population. It can't be by happenstance. It has to be an active decision to go out and say, for this trial to be successful, we have to have at least 25% participation by minorities, and this is how we're going to do it. And until that's achieved, we won't close this trial.
Kent Tolkey is the Chief Scientific Officer and Executive Vice President of PRA Health Sciences. More in a moment.
While most of us were social distancing inside, what were the animals up to?
Coyote sightings are on the rise in our state, and while the coronavirus pandemic may be playing a part, it may simply be because more residents are at home.
I'm Laura Pelliser.
And I'm Elizabeth Friend. There was one wildlife species we certainly noticed in new ways while on lockdown for COVID-19.
Check out Creep, a new audio special from North Carolina Public Radio. Discover and learn more at WUNC.org.
Reparations is having a moment. The concept of compensation for descendants of people who built our nation while enslaved has never been talked about nor considered in such a high-profile way before this current election season. And while a federal plan is far from reality, there have been efforts on campuses and in communities across the country. This week, the City Council in Asheville unanimously approved a reparations plan to support Asheville's Black community.
The blood capital that we have banked to spend today to fight for significant change came predominantly not from our allies, but from Black men, women, and children who died to get to this very moment. Generation, so to speak. Hundreds of years of Black blood spilled that basically fills the cup that we drink from today.
Keith Young is a member of the City Council and spearheaded the strongly worded resolution. The measure calls on the city to create a community reparations commission. Part of the group's job will be designating funds to strengthen minority ownership of homes and businesses and close gaps in health care, education, and employment.
There is this concept that is the American dream, that we all have equal opportunity to generate the kind of wealth that brings meaning to the words life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Even though Black Americans, we've been denied that.
The measure also formally apologizes for the city's participation in the enslavement of Black people and for enforcing segregation and, quote, its accompanying discriminatory practices. The city's vote is a big step in recognizing the history of systemic racism and addressing the barriers that have prevented Black families from generating wealth. But is reparations the right word for it? A. Kirsten Mullen is the co-author of From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. She told me that atonement would be a better word to use than reparations. She says the measure is a really nice gesture, but will not come close to closing the huge racial wealth gap. The average wealth of a white family is nearly 10 times more than that of the average Black family. Nevertheless, Mullen said this measure will hopefully do some good on the ground. Councilman Keith Young recognized this issue is far from over, but it's a good place to start.
I am a Black man with a Black family, and anything that we do, in my mind, has to outlive the emotions of this present moment, because the future success of my own children in our current and future society depends on the sustained success of the systemic changes that we seek, and not just the budgetary priorities in the moment, albeit important as well. We can multitask, but to say it bluntly, this is our moment. These are our lives, and this is our capital.
That's it for this episode of Test It. I'm Leonida Inge. Charlie Shelton Ormond is our producer. Lindsay Foster Thomas is the executive producer. Thanks for listening.